The Inside Ellen Road podcast is sponsored by PR Supplies at Unit 2 Wither Park Industrial Estate, Leeds, postcode LS53AP. Check out PR Supplies on Facebook for all your home retail needs. Hello, welcome back to the Inside Elland Road podcast. It was yet another wet and miserable day in Plymouth for Leeds United to contend with over the weekend. Everything but the result and performance, that is. After clinching their 8th league win in a row with a 2-0 victory at Home Park, the Argyle Omnibus, the Plymouth Odyssey, whatever you want to call it, is done and dusted once and for all. 4 games, 3 wins. Leeds will not be playing them again anytime soon, we hope. 7 clean sheets in 8, Graham, not really looking like they're going to concede at all. You know, Leeds fans have gone the distance this month, but the lads have delivered and repaid them with goals, performances, wins, and no doubt excellent memories. How would you assess the first 18 or 19 days of the month of February?
Czechoslovakia. I feel like we've been to Czechoslovakia and back. A return visit. Yeah, it's been brutal, hasn't it? It's been really, really brutal on the players. And I think you maybe saw that a little bit at Plymouth. It's been brutal on the fans because they've had to. I was chatting to guys on the train to Plymouth, and you know they're talking about it's just rinsing their days off, really. You know, one guy had his laptop with him and was technically officially at work. It's just been expensive. Time. It's been a time sponge, this period of travel. And yet Leeds United have kind of rolled through it like a well-oiled steam engine, just chugging their way through the games in really quite impressive fashion.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying a steam engine there. They could be compared to a bit of a freight train at the moment because they've taken maximum points from their championship games in 2024. As I say, 8 wins on the spin, still unbeaten across all competitions when you factor in the FA Cup games as well. It's not as though the Plymouth game looked as though, or they were kind of coming to the end of this run, and maybe they were, you know, one of those cases where it's a team that, you know, they've got quality, but they maybe didn't deserve to win. I think they did deserve to win. You know, Ian Foster, the Plymouth manager, said that, they'd limited an unbelievable side in this division to just 2 shots on target. But even still, Leeds were clinical. They were ruthless, similar to what they were right at the beginning of that Swansea game last week. They are playing really, really well. Defensively, they look solid. I could count on one hand sort of the dangerous opportunities that Plymouth had at Home Park on Saturday lunchtime. And I mean, let's not forget, this is a team in Plymouth that their home form is very, very strong. They can hurt you in transition. They're one of the best, if not the best team, certainly the most prolific team in the division at those sorts of attacking moves. And prior to Leeds' arrival, I think it was, you know, they routinely score 2 and 3 goals at home every single game. So it was, again, another a job to keep a clean sheet. Again, excellent work. But as I'm saying, you know, you could count on one hand the number of clear-cut opportunities. I'm actually struggling to think beyond that really dangerous cross that Mikel Miller put in. And I think it was it Ben Wayne or Alfie Devine that was stretching to try and get to it at the far post. But apart from that, you wouldn't say that, you know, Ilan Melier was called into action too frequently. So, yeah, long may it continue.
Yeah, they just don't look like conceding. Melier, from memory, he had that free kick that tried to catch him out at the near post that he kind of, was it Whittaker struck it? He dove and shoveled it away. He dealt well, I thought, with corners, set pieces. He did spill the ball quite dangerously in the second half. But there weren't any huge saves, were there? There weren't any top-class bits of goalkeeping that he had to produce because he is being protected in a way that arguably he's never been protected before. I mean, when he first came into the team, when Kiko Kasea was out of the team after his FA ban, then Melier was pretty well looked after, but he still had saves to make. I think he still had a few 1v1 situations to deal with. We're certainly not seeing anybody get through 1v1, are we? Mm. We're not seeing him exposed in the way that he was in the last two seasons in the Premier League, you know, when he was really very badly exposed and left to hang out to dry in just a horrible way, really. And that really did have a massive impact and really, really hurt his confidence. That's not happening at all. You know, Leeds are controlling teams and controlling games. And it wasn't my favourite performance. I wouldn't be keen to watch that game back. But for me, it was still a comfortable 2-0 win, even if Leeds didn't create a huge amount of clear-cut chances. It was still comfortable.
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't routine, as I'm saying, because, you know, the Plymouth are a decent side at home, and it, especially at half-time, that was a pretty even game. They were very much in the fight. But as they had a bit more of the pressure, a bit more of the ball, a bit more of the attacking in the early periods of the second half, it didn't feel... I mean, obviously, we've watched a lot of Leeds United over the past couple of years. Didn't feel as though previous iterations of this Leeds team where the pressure was going to tell at some point. It was, well, they are threatening, but they're not, you know, that again, they're not creating clear-cut opportunities. And ultimately, it took a bit of quality from Jorginho Rutter to put the game to bed. And then after that, the game was a foregone conclusion. Everybody kind of knew that it was going to be another win for Leeds. And yeah, looking at the table is making for really appetizing reading lately. And you shared something on Twitter shortly after the game, or was it the day after? I can't remember. They're all paling into one now. I just feel like I'm spending so much of it on trains. That it was the comparison between the table after the West Brom game on the 28th of December to after this most recent Plymouth match. And the points makeup is quite staggering.
Yeah, 8 wins in a row is just, it's remarkable, really, in any division. I mean, to take a block of 24 points and to take all of them,
Just to gobble them up like a game of hungry hippos.
Like hungry hippos, yeah. You're not leaving any points. That's my point. Give me that point. Yeah, it is remarkable, and the way the table has changed is remarkable. And I've seen a few people say, "Oh, we shouldn't get too excited about this." You know, Southampton still have a game in hand, etc., etc. Would you take this situation over the way it was looking after West Brom? I mean,
Yes.
Yeah, I think I probably would. And you think of the mood after West Brom, and you think of a lot of the flack that Farke came in for. You know, everybody was getting it. You know, those people that were just like they had the Tommy gun out, and they were just pirouetting round and round, blasting at everyone
from the hip. You know, yeah,
we were getting it for not asking him the tough questions that would bring about another victory, or for questioning him hard enough on his subs and his tactics, and there was genuinely people calling for him to go, like genuinely. It may have been a very vocal, very small minority, but there were calls there. The evidence is still there to be found, actually, on social media. People have not deleted the receipts as yet. But you fast forward to now, and you think, that was all a bit silly, really. You know, that outcry, that level of outcry, the intensity of it was a bit silly and a bit premature. And I think when you stand back and look at the full picture of where Farke has brought them after the summer they had, then I think you can only be delighted if you're a Leeds United fan, and you can only really give Farke the credit he deserves. Because what he's built in the time he's had, you know, and he came in late, let's remember, you know, he came in late. They got the squad together late. You know, it was right at the end of the window that they completed their business. I mean, the Kamara deal, I mean, good grief. Imagine if they hadn't got that done now, how different things could look.
Imagine if he'd set off walking a day later.
Exactly. Or if he'd, you know, developed a blister and had to rest for a day at Carlisle. I just think when you look at the full picture from start to finish, then you have to be impressed. The position they've got into, the shape they're in, despite the injuries as well. I mean, the first half of the season, Farke really wasn't getting anything out of Bamford, Nyonto, Anthony, Cruyff. You could probably throw in there, Cruyff. He wasn't getting anything from Cruyff because his cameos had been pretty underwhelming and his starts had not been great. And now, you know, look at the difference. Cruyff is a nailed-on starter. Willy Nyonto has 5 goals in 5 games. Bamford might be injured right now, but the difference he made to the side in recent games.
He was a catalyst at the start of the year, wasn't he?
It's been fantastic, really. And it's like Farke is building something, and he's been building it steadily, and he's been building it to this point with this very thing in mind, because he's done this before. This is what he does. He does great big long winning streaks and unbeaten streaks. Did it with Norwich twice to win the title. And he's put Leeds within striking distance of Leicester in a way that none of us could have imagined, you know, on New Year's Eve. Who within their right mind, Joe, which reasonable thinking person of sound mind was looking at that and going, you know what? Leeds will be 9 points back after 19 days of February. And if they beat Leicester, they'll go 6 points behind. And actually then there'll be a title race. Nobody thought that. Farke might have thought it. He certainly wasn't saying it, but nobody thought that. And yet here we are.
I don't know about you, but I wasn't really thinking about Leeds too much on New Year's Eve. New Year's Day, I definitely was because of that Birmingham game. But yeah, it's just kind of compartmentalizing it, these things. You are right, though. I mean, 19 days of February is quite ridiculous. To have made up 24 points in that period of time is nothing short of remarkable. And the stretch of games that they've had to do it in as well. You know, this, I've said it before, this was a stretch which has the potential to break teams. You know, you've got all of this travel, you've got all of the, you've got the addition of the FA Cup in there as well. You've got, you know, the different timings of games, you know, the quick turnarounds, the not having the opportunity to train and to work on things on the training pitch that Farke might want to implement in upcoming games. All of those things, you know, do go into how successful a team is or unsuccessful. And yet Leeds have come out the other side with, you know, maximum points, which begs the question, when they do have a spare week and they're able to be on the training pitch from Monday to Thursday, Monday to Friday, or whatever it is, then, what, you know, just how much better can they get? Obviously a word as well for all of the fans. I was looking at somebody, their Twitter account, the other day after the Plymouth match. And I was sort of like making a mental note of all the away games that they'd been to. And I think this person in particular had been to every single one this month, every single one at the beginning of January and throughout that month as well. And it's just an outstanding undertaking to go to Plymouth twice. I mean, you know, we've made a big song and dance about it, but you know, at the end of the day, that's our jobs. You know, we're being paid to go there. These are people taking days off work, as you mentioned, you know, spending money hand over fist to go and follow the team, which, you know, there's no guarantee of success. You know, staying in hotels, you know, sleeping in cars on the way back up and down on service stations, you know, 2 a.m. starts, all of this sort of thing. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that, you know, people would do this en masse. And yet, you know, it's no surprise when you turn up at Plymouth and, you know, we're 5 minutes away from kickoff and there's an entirely full away end. It's just incredible. I mean, on that Friday evening in Plymouth, it felt as though there was sort of like a Leeds United takeover. You know, it's not a tiny city. It's a reasonably sized one. But it felt as though you couldn't walk for hearing a very broad Yorkshire accent.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You know, they bristle somewhat down there if you even dare to mention travel and distance, because every game for them, you know, is a travel. And, you know, there was a local journalist that I could actually feel him bristling. You know, it's like he puffed up to about three times his normal volume, and the bristles were sticking into me next to him, because Farke had the temerity to say that no team in Western Europe — he does love that, by the way, that's another Farkism — no team in Western Europe has had, you know, X, Y, and Z. No team in Western Europe has had to travel as far as Leeds have in the last few weeks. And then the same journalist brought it up with the Pilgrims boss, and you know, made the point that, well, he's probably not quite right there. But then I looked at the fixtures and I thought, no, actually, in the space of time we're talking about, Leeds have travelled further than Plymouth. And yeah, Plymouth have to do an awful lot of travelling. But, you know, that's where you are, Plymouth. That's where you live. You've made that choice. But in this short space of time, the travel that has been put on Leeds has been extraordinary. Really, really extraordinary. And because of the travel and because of the identity of the opponents, you know what it's like? It's like playing Mario Kart and you're second, and the person ahead of you has an unlimited supply of banana skins and they're just dropping them liberally. You know, Leeds have had to swerve their way through a lot of banana skins in this period. They could easily have dropped points. And the fact that the fans have been there in such voice the whole way through, it's like they've rewarded their fans.
It's been
like
a mushroom. You know, the golden mushroom where you can just keep tapping the controller and it just gives you a little speed boost. Every time they sing Somerville Strike and Pirou, that's just a little extra zzz, zzz. And to be fair, they've been catching up to Leicester. So, yeah, good analogy. But Mario Kart.
Thanks. Yeah, what has been good, I think, is that the fans' effort has not gone unrewarded. Like you say, there's no guarantees in football of success, and you don't travel in the expectation that you're going to be given something. You know, nobody travels saying, reward me for this travel. They travel because they love to watch Leeds United, and the experience, like the Friday night in Plymouth, is all part of it. You know, for those fortunate enough to be able to afford that and to be able to get down on the Friday and stay down on the Friday, that was a whole part of the game experience, the match day experience. The bars on Friday night, the lots of little pubs along the Barbican. It was really, despite the weather, it was actually fantastic. The atmosphere was superb. Everybody was in fine fettle, probably because their team had won 7 on the bounce, and they were maybe, you know, thinking we could do 8 tomorrow. But that's all part of it. You know, when you make the sacrifice to go down there, you do get rewarded by more than just the football. But it has been nice that they've also been rewarded by the results. And even if that wasn't champagne football on Saturday morning, it has to be said, horrific conditions. I mean, just pigging again, absolutely pigging. That's twice we've been there. I'm sure it's a gorgeous place when the sun shines. I'm just not altogether certain that the sun has ever or will ever shine there. I think it just rains. Because 100% of the times that I've been there, it's rained heavily.
Same with Swansea, same with Bristol.
Yeah, just honking weather. And like I said, in those conditions, it wasn't going to be a classic for the neutral. And we'll come on to maybe the broadcasters getting their comeuppance on that score later. But what they did get was two fantastic goals. I mean, let's talk about the goals. Nyonto's first. That ball from Routere, you could describe it as an aimless up and under, or you could watch it from the angle opposite the main stand and see that he had a quick look as he turned, as he took receipt of a throw-in. He took a quick look, saw where Nyonto was. Nyonto had isolated a defender 1v1. Routere just turns and sweeps the ball high. And yes, there's an element of the speculative about it, but you're essentially back in Nyonto's pace, aren't you, to get there ahead of the defender, which he did. And even if his first touch didn't kill the ball stone dead, it actually worked out better. I think if he's killed the ball stone dead there, he's got no angle to shoot from, really. But the first touch takes it away from him and the defender. He's quick enough to spring around the other side and then squeeze a really lovely finish in off the far post. It was just tremendous. And we would not have seen Willie Nyonto do that in, you know, October, November, December. He's a different player altogether from the one that we saw earlier in the season. And that I really do think that Bristol goal has just set a fire to him, set a fire underneath him, and he's off and running.
Absolutely, he's a child reborn, still a teenager, believe it or not. But that goal, it just the up and under from Ruter or whatever you want to call it, it reminded me a lot of. I don't know. Did you watch it? I mean, probably about 15 years old now. Wayne Rooney's Street Striker, when they had that challenge where they dropped loads of balls from obviously one at a time, but from like a block of flats, and you had to control it, turn, and then dink it into a skip behind you. That's what really Nyonto's goal reminded me of, because he had to basically drop it. He had to take it down, you know, having. In difficult conditions, the ball practically had snow on it. He's taken it around a defender, so he's added an extra element to the Street Striker challenge. And then he's found the back of the net, so he's found the skip. I just thought that was... I was half expecting to turn to my left or my right, and, you know, in the press box, Andy Anser with his glasses was going to be there just going, "Unbelievable, Techers," or something along those lines. But no, we didn't. We had Don Goodman on comms on Sky instead, so... maybe less enthusiastic.
Slightly.
Great finish.
I do have to pick you up on one inaccuracy there. He's not a teenager, he's 20. So
is he?
Yeah, jot that down.
Man.
No longer a teenager.
Oh yeah, because it's 2024 now, isn't it?
I mean, he's not a girl, not yet a woman, I would say. He's in that kind of that in-between period. Still very much a youth, I think, but ultimately not a teenager. And then second goal.
Tell you what, have a look at his Wikipedia picture. Right, it's fantastically low res, but it's fantastically Nyonto as well. Bonus points if you can tell Bonus points if you can tell me whose little chunk of head there is in the bottom right-hand corner.
Carl Robinson.
It is Carl Robinson, yep.
Fantastic. I wasn't aware of that tongue sticking out picture. A well-taken goal. That's 5 in 5. And Dan James, you know, he's got his work cut out to get back into the team, hasn't he? He really does at the minute. And then the second goal comes from Farke's swapping of Ruter and Piru. And at the risk of opening up the old can of worms for the 17th time this season, Ruter and Piru, I think it was the right decision to swap them when he did, because I got the logic, because Ruter's legs were starting to feel it. And you can understand that. He's had a huge amount of minutes recently, a huge amount of involvement as well. Played a lot of football. So I could understand if he was struggling to cover the necessary distance in the 10 role, you know, as that second half went on. So Piru, who is right up there with Cruyff as one of Leeds' highest distance runners during games, he moved into 10. Ruter went up front. Piru gets on the ball from an Archie Gray win and slides it into Ruter. And he still had a lot to do, didn't he, to finish that off. But refused my advice of maybe shooting it to either side of the goalkeeper. Absolutely determined to fire it through the goalkeeper. And he managed to double nutmeg with that strike. I mean, it's a fantastic shot. You know, how many times recently have we seen him? He's hit a shot like that and a defender's got a foot to it or a leg or a backside to it, or the keeper saved it. And this one was just perfect. Just a daisy cutter, but a really, really hard one. Just kick it really hard, as Normanton would say. And he's managed to nutmeg a defender and the goalkeeper, and that goal's wrapped it up. And that's... Fans will remember that. They'll remember Ruter celebrating with them, and they'll remember the full-time celebrations, and that is probably enough.
Yeah. It brings me back to what Jesse Marsh said when Ruter signed for Leeds, when he said he's one of the best ball strikers he'd ever seen, or he's like one of the best two-footed strikers of a ball. And it looked as though that this was something that Jesse was wrong about, but I think over the past, I don't know, recent period, shall we say, maybe not in terms of accuracy, but in terms of the power he's able to get behind them, you'd say there's very few players in that Leeds squad who can strike a ball as hard and as sort of arrowed as Jorginho. So long may that continue.
Needless to say, Jesse had the last laugh. and he deserved the goal. You know, goal and assist just keeps him ticking over in terms of end product. And they really are sharing the end product out. You know, it's not, they're not overly reliant on one man. I think a lot of people would have put money on Pirou being the top scorer this season and finishing the season on like 20, 25. I don't think anyone would have put money on Dan James being where he is in double figures. Somerville, you could have seen scoring a fair few. But now that Nyonto has got five, you know, Bamford's got a few, they're sharing it out, aren't they? And if one's not having a great day, Somerville, for example, at Plymouth, didn't have his best game by any stretch, but someone else pops up with a goal. And it's the same at the other end of the pitch, because Firpo didn't have his greatest game. And Rodon, actually, for the first time in ages, we saw a few wobbly moments from him. You know, he wasn't at his absolute best. Ethan Ampadu stepped up and was absolutely superb, just there every time when Leeds needed him, and there doing the right thing, making a sensible choice, brought a lot of physicality to it. And Archie Gray, again, I thought he had maybe one moment in the first half where he got bypassed a bit too easily, but the rest of the game, he was pretty much in control.
Yeah, just looking at the top scorers list here. So for all competitions, you've got Somerville on 16, Pirou on 11, Dan James on 10, Jorginho on 7, Nyonto on 6, and then you've got Bamford and Stroik on 5 apiece. That is a lot of goals. And it's almost like everyone in that front line is, and Pascal Stroik, is contributing. And it's not as though they're just contributing goals either. You know, you look at the assists as well. You've got, you know, Jorginho's got 12 assists, which is, you know, fantastic. I think eight or nine of them are for Somerville, which in itself is pretty unique. Somerville's got 9 assists. And just on that, his pass accuracy is 85%. For a player in his position, with the number of assists that he has, because he's obviously trying very... you know, ambitious passes. He's basically trying to play that final pass before a goal a lot of the time. To maintain 85% pass accuracy over the course of like 2,500 minutes is pretty astonishing. But then you've also got Dan James on 7 assists, Junior Firpo 4, Glenn Kamara on 3, and then you've got, I think, 6 or 7 players on 2 assists each. So, yeah, it's not just the goal scoring that's coming from everywhere. It's the creating as well. I'm going to ask you a difficult question here, Graham. I know my answer, obviously, because I'm the one asking it. Are Leeds the best team in the Championship?
Oh, that is a toughie. Right now, I would say yes. They are the form team, aren't they? You know, nobody can match their record over the last 8 games. You know, Southampton dropped, didn't they? So, yes, I would say they are. And I don't think it's too difficult to back up. I really don't. I mean, ultimately, it's irrelevant, you know, because only when you're there with 46 games played, you know, can you really judge the table. Maybe if you're on the sofa with a piece of cake and a cup of coffee. But right now, yeah, I'd have no problem saying they're the best team in the Championship.
Okay, so my response to that, my riposte, if you will, is I've just sent you on WhatsApp a link. And if you scroll down on that link, past the expected goals for, past the expected goals against, you'll see a fancy looking chart. And it's headlined team style comparison. And you'll notice that in the bottom right hand corner, you've got two teams which who are outliers, both Southampton and Leicester. And they're next to a label on the graph which says slow and intricate, because basically that is how they attack. Leeds aren't in that little quadrant alongside those two teams. They are somewhere nearer the middle, with fewer passes per sequence but a faster direct attacking speed. And my riposte is that they're not the best team in the league at the moment. I know that Leicester have just lost, but again, they do have more points, and that does tend to show which team is the best. They definitely are the most entertaining team. They are, which again gets us onto the whole Sky and TV broadcasters debate and why are Leeds always on telly? Well, because they're the most watchable. They definitely are the most watchable, the most entertaining, the best team from a neutral perspective, is what I'd say. Do you have any assessments of that little team styles grid comparison graph map, whatever you want to call it?
I don't know, really. It's interesting. I don't think I've ever looked at this before. Sorry, it took me a while. I had to unblock you on WhatsApp first.
Very good.
Yeah, so Southampton, they'll plod you to death, basically. They'll just pass and pass and pass and pass, won't they? And then eventually find a gap. Looks like Leicester are almost exactly the same team as Southampton based on this. You probably do want to be, in terms of entertainment, you probably do want to be where Leeds are, because it shows that you're mixing it up, you know, and that I think where Leeds are absolutely at their best. There's two phases that I really like. I like when Rodon's telling everybody just to calm down. They've got the ball at the back. They stroke it left to right or right to left, and then the ball goes out wide. You know, they've gone to the left. The opposition have shifted. Then they come back to the right and Rodon plays it down the wing to Gray or to the winger. And then a bit of rotation with the winger and the fullback, and a midfielder will come in to help them. A little bit of quick passing triangles. And then they get to the byline and they cut it back. I really, really like that, because you know it's coming and yet it appears to be very, very difficult to stop. But I also really like when they break, and because they counter so quickly, like Yondu's goal against Swansea, when if you've got Cree Somerville breaking, like Norwich away, if he's breaking from deep, you're going to be in trouble if there's space. And Routier as well. How many times have we seen him, you know, crossing the halfway line into space after beating somebody with a dribble and then opening up the game completely? That, for me, is good football to watch.
It just really jogged my memory there when you mentioned Routier for some reason on the counter. I had a dream with that our line manager did not believe the hype around Jorginho and was asking what's all the fuss about. So you and I decided to send in our sort of work group chat our sort of appraisals, and I decided to compare him. And I've not had this sort of epiphany consciously, but subconsciously, clearly I'm still thinking about Leeds. And I said that the way that he's able to take the ball in a deep position, roll a midfield player, roll a defender, and then just advance pretty much to the edge of the box of his own accord, very much like what Yaya Toure used to do for Manchester City. Just, it, so easily shrug opposition players off.
Yeah. I was thinking about this, not in a dream, but do you remember when they played at Chelsea last year and Routier came into the team and he was like, it was like they'd stuck a great big trampoline in the middle of the pitch, and then they would kick the ball to the trampoline and the trampoline would do what a trampoline does, and it would bounce off and it would roll off and it would ping off and it would ricochet, and it never stuck. He found it really, really hard to make the ball stick. Farke didn't really want to play him as a 10 for that reason, I think. That was one of the aspects of not playing him as a 10 and playing him as a 9, was that he didn't think Routier's hold-up play was quite good enough yet to trust him there. Because what he wants is, when the ball goes in there, that he does hold off the defender and then he rolls him and he gets by him, or he links somebody. Saw a little bit of that with Routier, didn't we, in the first half against Plymouth, where the ball went into Routier or it went into Pirou. And then they found each other within five yards or so of each other and linked.
A little layoff,
and then you're in behind. And whether it's work on the training ground that's done it, or whether it's simply just game time or getting used to the role, Routier has got better and better and better at holding the ball up. And I don't know if I'd say he's better than Patrick Bamford at it, because Bamford's hold-up play is very good. But he does it in a different way, because you have no idea what he's going to do. And I'm not even sure that Roter has an idea. When the ball's being played into his feet, until he touches it, I don't know that he's got an idea of what he's going to do. But he might flick it between your legs. He might flick it between his legs. He might do a Cruyff turn. He might lay it off. You've no idea. He might just hold it up and play it back to someone. He's really unpredictable and really, really. And because he's so big, it's another aspect of his game that is fairly underrated. The strength that he has to hold defenders off. He's got big old legs on him. We're not talking Pascal Struyck legs, but he has substantial legs.
Footballer's legs.
Yes, he has footballer's legs. You know, if Bielsa had gone into his room to have a look at him while he slept, I think he'd have said yes, footballer, because he's really quite good now. And we've seen it actually in his defensive third as well quite a lot. When he goes back there, either to help win the ball or to take receipt of a defensive throw, he'll hold off the defender and he'll either find space or find a teammate to do something with it. He's become really quite trustworthy in possession. In saying that, his hold-up play wasn't fantastic at Plymouth, and that, I think, is why one of the reasons why Farkas swapped him to put him in nine. But I think this rest period will do him. I say rest period, you know, like
they've got 4 days.
Like they've got a full week off or whatever.
But it's a rest period for us.
I think this week we'll be majoring on just reducing the workload and the intensity and just letting legs recover a little bit so that they're really fresh to go at Leicester again on Friday night.
Yeah, someone described this as a deload week. You know, if you did triathlons, Graham, you'd probably know what that term means, but a deload week is this. What are you laughing at? That was a very astute,
that's very funny. That's very funny, Joe. It's a very funny joke.
It is because Graham's done around 10 triathlons, as he told me in Plymouth.
So, you know, you sometimes asked. I didn't just turn and say, "Here, Joe, put down my pint. Guess what I've done?" You asked specifically for that information and I delivered it. Tell you what else I had to deliver on Friday night in Plymouth in the pub. So a lot of Leeds fans in there. We were there with our good friends, Adam Pope and John Newsome. Our friend, your hero, John Newsome. And we'd been out for dinner. We'd gone out for a drink. And John Newsome in his element, you know, surrounded by Leeds fans. Adam Pope as well in his element. Like two giant entertainers surrounded by fans. And you and I went for a sit down and I had a bit of chat with a Leeds fan who told me that he wears shorts all the time. Only twice in the last year has he worn long trousers. On both occasions were funerals, which was fantastic information to volunteer. I just really loved it. I just thought it was a great story to tell. And then someone came to fetch me. Someone actually came from the other side of the pub to fetch me so that I could mount a defense of a player rating that I gave in the last game, because the last game that was 1-4-0, I rated a player too highly by a mark or two marks, depending on which of my accusers you were listening to. And the need was felt that I should be fetched to join the conversation so I could defend that rating, which...
But I did very much enjoy that up until the point where you decided to throw me under the bus by saying, "Oh, well, JD suggested that you should probably get a 7.
Sometimes you have to share responsibility. You have to share the load. You can't just rely on one man.
It's a team game. Yeah,
that was great. I enjoyed that.
Remind me again, is it just your byline on the ratings?
Yeah, but, you know.
Yeah, team game, right? Team game.
If I win, we all win. what else I enjoyed was the broadcaster having to move their post-game interviews doing it in front of the Leeds fans was simply not a good idea. Explain, Joe, why it was not a good idea to do it in front of the Leeds fans.
Because there's a certain chant that Leeds fans like to sing, which has 5 words in it, and 2 of them are not broadcastable before the watershed.
and the chant specifically refers to the specific broadcaster of that game. And yeah, that chant...
And so much so, that even the Plymouth fans at one point joined in. You know, these are Plymouth fans who really haven't been inconvenienced by Sky TV that much this season, as far as I'm aware. But fair play to them. They got on board with it, sticking it to the man. Yeah, very good. Well done, Plymouth. Yeah.
It was very, very funny, and it was a message sent. But as I wrote in my match report, you know, what's a little bit of inconvenience among friends, particularly when put next to a 2 a.m. coach start from the Peacock on Saturday morning. And it wasn't a game. It's almost like Leeds got exactly what they wanted from the game. The fans got what they wanted from the game, and they delivered the message they wanted to deliver. And the broadcaster didn't get the kind of game that they were after when they booked Leeds and Plymouth, because it wasn't a spectacle. It wasn't one for the neutral at all. Do I think it will deter them from picking Leeds again? No. As the Leeds fan on the train on the way down to me said, the only game that you looked at and thought nobody will be really bothered about that was the Millwall game, which has now been chosen for broadcast. So he would not be surprised.
They've invented a kickoff time for Leeds on telly.
Invented a 3 p.m. Sunday kickoff time just to get Leeds on the TV. And if they chose that game, then don't be surprised if they choose every game between now and the end of the season. And you could genuinely see it, because they are entertaining. They do play very good football. They score a lot of goals. Lots of people watch them. They make people talk. Lots of people hate them. And they're right up there in the title race, which is, maybe I shouldn't say title race yet. Maybe we'll wait to next week to talk about whether or not there's a title race, but there's definitely an automatic promotion race, which is going to be fascinating. So yes, expect to see a lot of Leeds on the telly between now and the end of the season.
Just going back to our little tales of Friday night in Plymouth, I do hope that if our distinguished colleague Adam Pope is listening, that his wrist has recovered from all the autographs that he was presumably signing in the pub. Because there was quite a swarm of Leeds fans around him and John Newsom, which, you know, it's very nice to see. But it's very good when, for example, one of them needed to sort of look over to the pair of us and sort of ask, would you like another drink? And that was pretty easy to see, because they just tower over everyone. I was saying to you, I don't think I've ever given Popey credit for how tall he is. He must have been one hell of a centre half back in the day, because he's pushing John Newsom levels. But yeah, all in all, a very good weekend for the books, with Leeds winning. I don't want to get too much into the Leicester preview, because an Inside Elland Road exclusive is that we are going to be doing two pods this week, because I don't know, it just feels like an important week in the season, doesn't it? You want to box off all the Czechoslovakia content, all the tales. We've definitely got enough to discuss in this episode. And then as well, the pre-Leicester one that we'll do on Thursday is going to be, I mean, that's massive. It's a huge game on Friday, isn't it? So I feel like we deserve to do, that game deserves a full and frank preview, rather than sort of the customary 5 or 10 minutes that we get at the end of these regular pods. But that's just a little reward for if you've managed to stick it out plus past the 40-minute mark, that you've got something to look forward to again on Thursday. I know, Graham, you're absolutely delighted thinking about that. Couldn't wait to fire off a text at 6 a.m. this morning going, should we do two pods this week?
Just feel like we haven't spent enough time together. Two goalkeepers on the bench at Plymouth, not for the first time this season. Discuss.
Well, Daniel Farker will say it's insurance, because you never know what could happen.
Yeah.
What do you think? Because you've decided that this is on the agenda. What do you think?
I don't like it. No, I do and I don't. Ultimately, if none of the 18s or the 21s have caught Farker's eye sufficiently to deserve a place on the bench, then he's doing the right thing. But I don't know. I do also like the idea of a young player who's on the right track being given the kind of the match day experience. I suppose the danger is that if there's no one in the 21s that's really doing it, and the players that you're really excited about in the 18s, and I think everyone would probably know the couple of names that you'd be thinking about, the problem is that they become the story then if they're on the bench. And I'm thinking about one in particular because of his name. and because of his brother playing in the team. I suppose the danger is that if you include one of someone like that, then that's all anybody wants to talk about, and they don't want to talk about the team and the winning record, and then it just takes a bit of focus away, maybe a slight distraction. But I don't know. I don't know. I always feel like two goalkeepers on the bench, I don't know. It feels like it's almost cheating. I don't know. There's something about it. There's something about it.
What benefit do you get from having two goalkeepers instead of one?
Well, I just don't like it. I just think there's something about it that I don't like. And I'm not sure. I can't quite put my finger on what it is. But yeah, having two goalkeepers just feels really superfluous to me. But I think what it also says to the club in general is that they're going to need a bigger squad next season, regardless of division. You know, they are going to need a bigger squad, because there have been times this season when Farke has not been able to name one substitute goalkeeper and then a full bench of outfield players because of injuries and whatnot. And I think a club of Leeds size and stature should be able to do that, regardless of the kind of three or four injuries you might be carrying at any one point.
Can I just jump in there?
Yeah, go on.
I now realise why you've decided to put this on the agenda, because you'd quite like to see a certain player of a certain nationality included on the bench for a first team game for the first time, wouldn't you? Might that be?
This is a scurrilous accusation to make.
I don't think it is.
It's absolutely scurrilous.
Would you happen to like to see Charlie Allen given a place in the matchday squad at some point?
Well, would you not, Joe? Who would not like to see a young player progress in the right direction?
Remind me again, which team he came from in Northern Ireland?
He came from Linfield. It's not my team.
What's significant about Linfield?
What's significant about Linfield? Well, they're from Belfast. They're from Northern Ireland. They play at Windsor Park.
Do they have a particular affiliation with one of the clubs in Glasgow?
I could say, you could probably say there's a slight preference going on there. I don't know if they've, I don't know if it's what you call a formalized link. I don't think there's an affiliation in the terms that you would see with the Citigroup. But reject.
That's fine.
That's utterly reject.
Sounding a bit like a bully's defense there.
I reject this scandalous accusation.
Objection, Your Honor, he's leading the witness. I'll be honest, I am leading the witness. But yeah, okay. I mean, I'd say arguably there is someone who is ahead of Charlie Allen in terms of deserving of a place on the bench. Maybe not quite yet, but in terms of talent and, you know, potential. But I don't really see, just to circle back on your point, I don't see too much of an issue that Farke's naming two substitute goalkeepers, because everybody else on the bench is getting minutes. You know, to be used on the bench, it shouldn't, to coin a Farkeism, it shouldn't be a gift. It shouldn't be we'll put you on there just for the matchday experience. If you're on there, you have to contribute.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, if Melier gets sent off and Claesson gets injured, or in Farke's example, you know, Melier picks up an injury in warm-up, Claesson comes in and gets sent off or injured, and then he looks like a real clever dick, doesn't he? He looks like a genius. And he can just wink at everybody in the way he did coming down the tunnel at Swansea. I just don't know if we'll see that happen in my lifetime. It's very rare that you would lose two goalkeepers. And even if you did, I suspect that Archie Gray is probably absolutely superb between the sticks. He just seems like the type, doesn't he, that, you know, now and again, just for the hell of it, he'd go in goal when he was like playing with his mates, and he'd be absolutely sensational. I wonder who else actually in the squad would fancy it. There's always one, isn't there, that's like everybody knows them as a bit of a wannabe goalkeeper. I wonder who it is.
Yeah, that would be interesting to know. Just off the top of my head, I believe that there was an instance in the Premier League probably about 10 or 11 years ago now, where a certain club did lose their first choice and second choice, I think maybe third choice goalkeeper in the 2014-15 season, and then were relying on playing basically an academy player as the goalkeeper in the Premier League for 6 matches. So there is the potential for that. So it's not something that hasn't happened in your lifetime, Graham. It has.
Yeah. Can I also say, go on. I've seen dogs run onto pitches in football matches. Yeah. We've seen a man land with a parachute in a boxing ring. But these things might happen once or twice, but they're very, very unlikely to happen again.
If only there was a turn of phrase to describe that, maybe once in a lifetime. I want to, in the interest of speculating on who is the best outfielder in goal, Daniel Farke has made a few comments, and we've strung them out relentlessly, as we do, about eating cake and having a cup of coffee on the sofa after winning games, or, you know, at the end of the season. I don't think at this point have we speculated on which type of coffee and which type of cake that Daniel might be indulging in.
I would imagine his coffee order would be fairly simple. I don't foresee him ordering an oat milk decaf hazelnut latte.
Nothing wrong with decaf.
Wrong with that. That would be my, if I was going to drink that poison, you know, that would be my choice. But I imagine he has his coffee black.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't imagine anything else, really. And
what you mean? You mean the man that turns up for every match day wearing all black everything? He isn't going to have his coffee black as well.
Yeah, I foresee that. And in terms of cake, maybe a Battenberg. What else might he like? There's that German cake that a friend of ours is German, and once I think we did it wrong actually. She gives you this like half mixed up already recipe, and you're meant to take from it a bit and bake a cake from it, and then give the rest to someone else, or you're meant to use it and then you half make up the rest of the recipe again and give it to someone else and they use it. I can't quite remember. But it was a really, really lovely cake, and that was German. So maybe somebody who's listening will know what that's about, because I've really told that story terribly.
That was awful.
Awful telling of a story. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he likes a Black Forest Gatto.
Perhaps. Maybe a strudel?
Maybe a pastry-based cake.
Well, okay, what I'm going to say now is I've gone on to allrecipes.com. And there are actually 17 different German cakes that they've listed there. For, you know, as long as that list is as long as the number of players that Daniel Farke has used. You've got Apfelkuchen, which is, for any linguists out there, apple cake. Can't see that being Farke's cup of tea.
I think that's what we had, apple cake.
Right, okay. Just because it's the first one I named. And it gets you out of a jam. Yes, that's the one. Yep. Sure, it wasn't a bee sting cake. Love this. Bienenstich. Bee sting. What's this? Traditionally, Bienenstich was a large sheet cake, and bakeries in Germany still sell it that way by the slice. You might also wonder, is this bread or cake? Well, I'll tell you what, allrecipes.com. I was wondering that. It doesn't tell me what's in it. Oh, wait, no. Caramelized almond crust. I mean, you're probably allergic to something like that, so I'll get away from the bee sting cake. But yeah, I don't know. I think maybe come the end of the season, if we get the opportunity, we should ask him which cake and which coffee are you going to be enjoying?
Cafe and Kuchen.
A what? Coffee, sorry?
Cafe und Kuchen.
Excellent coffee, GCSE German there.
Yes, coffee and cake. My only German that I can remember, I didn't do GCSE, I didn't take it as far as that, is Ja natürlich.
Were they still called O-levels then?
and I was speaking West German at the time. Ja natürlich, ich habe keine Hunger which I think means, yes, naturally, I have no hunger. Or, ja, natürlich, you'll notice the theme, ich habe keine Gummibärchen, which means, yes, naturally, I have no gummy bears. That's about the height of it for me.
Okay. That's not going to help you. It might help you with Jesse Marsh, but probably not with Daniel Farke. I honestly, I had sort of like a German awakening when Jesse was at Leeds. You know, just the terms that he would come out with, Rheingehen. You know, this is not a Freundschaftsspieler. That's a personal favorite. Yeah, I know. I think I could go toe to toe in very, very basic German. I think actually, of the Leeds United press pack, not knowing what languages they speak, I think I probably speak the most German.
Okay, well, we'll put that to the test on Friday.
We will, actually, yeah. I honestly really back myself with that. And I've not spoke German for years. So, yeah, we'll see.
That's great. Well done. I think that about wraps it up, doesn't it?
No, you're not allowed to do that. I wrap up the podcast. No. Nine! That felt like I was almost doing a little Alan Partridge bit there, so I'll, you know, reel that back in. Yeah, have we got anything else to discuss? Because we're going to do our predictions and everything on the second podcast of the week. Yeah,
I think that's about it. Our feed is end pet.
Yeah, I think that is just about everything on dieses Woche auf der Inside Ellen Road podcast. Auf Wiedersehen. And, you know, that's a very formal way of doing it. Probably just because we're such good friends with the listeners, it's probably just be a simple tschüss. So, Graham, would you like to do the honours?
Tschüss.
Great. Right. Thank you for listening. We'll be back later this week. Bye for now.
The Inside Ellen Road podcast is sponsored by PR Supplies at Unit 2 Wither Park Industrial Estate in Leeds. PR Supplies, everything for the home.